Actually, I would say if I you were to do the a look at it, I would say that probably more Grey Cup games have been more entertaining than most Super Bowls.
Yeah. Especially for athletes who, aren't making exactly big cash. Okay. So we'll continue on with the heart. We got to the atrioventricular valves, of course, which are the bicuspid and tricuspid valves. And that's between obviously the between the atria and the ventricles. Now the other ones are called the semilunar valves, and these separate between the ventricles and the vessels that, of course, the ventricles are pumping to. So as we know, on the right side, the right ventricle pumps blood into pulmonary circulation, so that would pass through the pulmonary valves. And on the left side, of course, the left atria and left ventricle is pumping blood into the aorta. So on the left side, it is the aortic valve. Now they're called semilunar because they kind of look like a moon, or like a, I don't know, they look like a moon. They're found at the aorta and pulmonary veins respectively, and their whole purpose is to prevent backflow into the ventricles where the blood was originally when it got ejected out of those two chambers. Both of them are three cusps that are said to be moon-like or moon-shaped. And of course, like the AV valves, they too are related to pressure. So, there's changes in pressure between both sides of the valve, which either open the valve or close the valve, dependingly. So we can see them here. Here were our atrioventricular valves, our tricuspid valve, and bicuspids. But what we're talking about are these semilunar valves. Again, on the right side is the pulmonary semilunar valve, and on the left side is the aortic semilunar valve. We can see them here when they're opened. You can see the three cusps here that make up the valves. You can see the aortic semilunar valve here that's opened, right? And this would be blood leaving the left ventricle heading into the aorta to go into systemic circulation. So again, closed on the left, opened on the right. So, we've done a couple of things. We've talked about movement of blood. We know what chambers blood goes into. We know we have one-way valves that promotes blood to move in a particular way. Well, how does all that happen? How do we get muscular contraction? So, we need to take a little bit of a deeper look at cardiac muscle tissue. I kind of alluded to it a little bit in the other slide. As we said, they're shorter in length as compared to skeletal. We have these stair-step configurations with these branches. We have these intercalated discs, which have desmosomes and gaps junctions, which allows action potentials to move quickly between the fibers. Because, we want an action potential. The best way to remember an action potential is potential for action, right? It's a stimulation that causes contraction, which is the action. So it has to travel from cell to cell to cell in order for cells to be stimulated to do what they do best, which of course is to contract. And as we know, mitochondria are larger and there are more of them. So you can see this sort of interconnectedness as compared to when we look a little deeper at skeletal muscle, we have muscle fibers that run parallel to each other, but they don't have these cross bridges like the cardiac muscle does. So that means that, we have to create this action potential, and this action potential has to travel through the heart a very particular way. In so much as I've said to you, it's kind of a twist. It's still, the heart still beats top bottom, top bottom, top bottom. Okay? So the pathway of stimulation has to go through the heart in such a way that ensures that the heart does beat top bottom. So we have specialized cardiac muscle fibers that are inherently rhythmical. When you stimulate or when you want to do something with a skeletal muscle, such as writing in your laptops or blinking your eyes or whatever, those movements are coordinated through practice, which you've been doing since you were in like grade two sort of thing, grade three. But it's to do it, you say to yourself, I want to write the letter A or B or C. Now you've coordinated to do the movement,
But now what you have to do is your brain has to send the appropriate stimulation to the right muscles to create the letter A, or to throw a baseball, or hit a volleyball, or shoot a basketball, right? There's muscles in a particular pattern have to be stimulated by the nervous system in order for that pattern to happen, for the task to occur. That doesn't happen in the heart. In the heart, you have cells that can stimulate themselves, right? So we say they are inherently rhythmical. So on look at a cardiac muscle cell, it stimulates itself in rhythm. Action potential, action potential, action potential. What's the normal rate of heart? What's considered normal? 80. So that means that somewhere in the heart, there is an initiation of an action potential that occurs 80 times a minute on average. Okay, so it's rhythmical. It's not the nervous system that's sending a message from the brain to the heart that says, beat, beat, beat. The nervous system has nothing to do with the initiation of the heartbeat. It is the cells themselves which do it. Now, the nervous system is involved in the conduction system of the heart. If you don't have neural involvement, if the brain is not involved to some degree in the creation of the stimulation by this initial rhythmic cell, the actual heart rate is 100 beats a minute. So the nervous system doesn't initiate the beat, it influences the rate. So without a nervous system, the heart beats at 100 beats a minute. Under the influence of the nervous system, it beats at around 72 to 80, which we say. So these inherently rhythmic cells are called autorhythmic fibers because they are self-excitable. Okay, they're self-excitable. They create the action potential that excites themselves to stimulate a contraction. They repeatedly generate action potentials that create heart contractions, and these have the same effect as we see in skeletal muscle fibers. So they're just sending out an action potential that travels throughout the heart, which gives us this top-bottom contraction. So, we're going to just do this a little bit. Actually, I'm going to do this a little bit here. Okay. So, of course, we have our two atria. We have our two ventricles here, right? Right ventricle, left ventricle. Okay. So, they repeatedly generate these action potentials, which causes the contractions top-bottom. They will continue to excite the heart, even when the heart is removed from the body. And I'm going to see if I still have this. Oops, wrong one. Sorry, I'm going to go back one. And it is. Okay, so we're saying here they will continue to excite the heart even when the heart is removed from the body. If I could in such a way crack open your chest wall, take your heart out, and put it in a bowl of ice, and provide oxygen to that heart, it will contract. Okay? So I'm about to show you something that's exactly that. So I'm going to... What's that? Yeah, no. I'm not cracking any chest walls open. No. So this is a heart that's been removed. It's an enlarged heart, so it's got a cardiomyopathy. So there's a new heart coming, which you don't see, but they're probably in the midst of stitching the new transplanted heart in the patient, and this is the heart that's been removed. Okay, it has no neural stimulation. So there are cells that are creating action potentials. There are cells that are creating action potentials, even though in that instance there were no oxygen there at that point,
And the nervous system isn't there either. Pretty cool, huh? I think so. Everybody's about to run out the back door. Okay. Only 1% of the total heart fibers are represented as autorhythmic, and they represent two areas. There are two areas where we have sort of the creation of this movement of stimulation. The first is called the pacemaker. This sets the rhythm of the electrical excitation and ensures the atria contract first. So that means that in the atria, and it's actually right about here, we have an area of cells that initiate the rate. So this autorhythmic self-excitation starts here. And starting here through those branches, and there's in those intercalated discs and gap junctions, the action potential heads out in all directions, all the way to the other side. Okay? So both sides get stimulated first, so we get a top contraction first. But we need the stimulation to get to the bottom part of the heart because it has to contract as well. So we have a cardiac conduction system that conducts the action potential that was created in the atria to get down into the ventricles. It is a network of specialized cardiac muscle fibers that promote a pathway for each cycle of excitation. So this excitation that it was initiated here in the atria somehow has to get down here in the ventricles. Okay? So the system ensures that all fibers contract in a coordinated manner, thus ensuring efficiency. Because the conundrum is, or the problem is, when this excitation, this action potential gets to the ventricles, we have a very large surface area here that has to contract as one. Because it's going to start up here and have to get down and around. So how do we do that? How do we ensure that the action potential travels so quickly that to the naked eye it looks as though the ventricles are contracting as one? We have a conduction system. So the first part of the conduction system is access between the ventricles and the atria through this little area right here. Okay? And we're going to get into these in a moment. Then from there, the action potential gets there. It travels down a bundle, like so, which then the bundle splits. Part of it goes this way, and the other part goes that way. So it gets initiated here. The action potential travels throughout the atria. It gets picked up by this little part here that's right at the floor of the right atria, and the action potential travels down the ventricular septum, interventricular septum, where near the apex it splits. One heads off to feed the right ventricle, and the other heads off to feed the left ventricle. And because of this conduction system, the action potential is able to travel extremely quickly down so that the entire lower part of the heart gets involved. So we can see it here. Here's our initiator here. Then we have a little specialized part of the conduction system here, travels down here through this singular area, splits again to spread out and involve the entire both right and left ventricles. So the first is called the sinoatrial node. It is the initiator. It is the one that's up in the right atria. Okay? It is in the right atrial wall, and it repeatedly depolarizes to threshold spontaneously. Okay, have I done this before with the positives and negatives of the cell membrane? Kind of, sort of. Right when I was talking about more hydrogen on one side and we created a gradient. Thank you. God, my brain wasn't working. Thank you. Yes. Okay. So when we look at a resting membrane,
Muscle. Whether that is skeletal or cardiac, it makes no difference. In the resting state, the outside of the membrane is more positive, and the inside of the membrane is more negative. That is a resting potential of a membrane. When a stimulation comes along, okay, when we have a action potential created, that action potential flips the charge. So a muscle that has been stimulated to contract now looks like this. It is the flip that gives us the charge that pumps the calcium via pumps using ATP that results in flipping the charge. The flipping of the charge is said to be in a depolarized state. Okay? When we flip the charge via the action potential, the membrane is depolarized. As the action potential travels along the membrane, this will return back to more positive on the outside, more negative on the inside. So when it returns back to the resting state, it is now said to be repolarized. So an action potential takes a resting membrane, flips the charge, thus depolarizing the either side of the membrane. And after the action potential is left, the membrane returns back to the resting, more positive outside, more negative inside, as now said, is said to be repolarized. So when I say here, the sinoatrial node, which is in the right atrial wall, it repeatedly depolarizes the threshold spontaneously. In other words, it is creating enough of a stimulation that all the muscle cells in the atria start depolarizing, and depolarizing equals contraction. When it's depolarized, it's contracting, okay? This little star here, then, is the SA node or the sinoatrial node, which is this thing right here, this little star shape here. So that's where it all starts. Next, we have what is called the atrioventricular node. This is the connection between the upper atria, which initiated the stimulation, and the continuation into the conduction system through the ventricles. So this little red thing here, this is the atrioventricular node, or the AV node. Right? The action potential created by the SA node reaches the AV node, which is kind of in this intraatrial septum. That's why I made kind of this long arrow coming in that direction. So that action potential will get to this AV node. The action potential slows down here, which allows time for the atria to empty of blood. So in this area, kind of right here, there's a configuration in the tissue here which has the action potential, which wants to travel at the appropriate speed, but it can't because of the way this is made in this area, and it deliberately slows down the action potential between the atria and the ventricles. Why? What do we need to finish before the ventricles contract? Atrial contraction, right. We want the atria to contract enough to push as much blood as possible into the ventricles, and we don't want the ventricles to start to contract until the atria are finished. So we have a deliberate sort of architectural design here in the fibrous skeleton, which slows down the action potential between the atria and the ventricles. So the AV node picks up the stimulation that was created by the SA node, and then it wants to travel down that conduction system. And right about here, it's slowed down just enough, which allows the atria to finish before the ventricles start. Okay? Yeah?
Okay. All right. Now we have this bundle here. So I'm going to, just so it's not confused, because it looks like it's two all the way through and it's not. I'm going to just kind of fill this in a bit to about here. And this is one solid bundle. Okay. This bundle is called the bundle of His, or the atrioventricular bundle. It's the only site where the action potential moves from the atria to the ventricles. So the action potential, which started at the SA node, has been picked up by the AV node, slowed down through that fiber skeleton between the atria and the ventricles, and then it gets to the other side, and boom, away it goes. So first it travels down the bundle of His, or the interventricular bundle, okay, traveling down here. And then what it's going to do, it's going to split. Remember I said it has one has to go to the left ventricle and one has to go to the right ventricle. These are known as the right and left bundle branches. Right? So this is the bundle of His. And then we have the left bundle branch. And the right bundle branch. And of course, that will conduct the action potential both to the lower parts of the right ventricle or lower parts and around the left ventricle. So it starts at the AV node, travels down the bundle of His, where then it separates and heads down both the right and the left bundle branches. So from the bundle of His, the action potential separates into the right and left bundle branches. And these branches extend from the AV bundle to the apex of the heart. So they come all the way down here to the apex. Once we get to the apex of the heart, the branches continue, but now they're called Purkinje fibers. So from here all the way around, these are your Purkinje fibers. And they have branches that head deep into the myocardium all the way along. Okay. So the Purkinje fibers are very large in diameter. What's the biggest problem with cable TV? Sorry? What gets in the way? Oh, okay. No, I just mean if you take a cable, say you're using cable TV, there's a limitation to that cable. What is it? What's that? No, speed. There is a it's diameter. So you actually none of you have 4K. No household in Canada has a 4K because the diameter of the cable is too small. Because it can't carry enough of the signal to actually give you a true blue 4K. Same thing here. We've created an action potential, and I want the action potential to travel as quickly as possible from the bundles and the bundle branches to get out into the distal fibers of the myocardium. So the Purkinje fibers are a large diameter fiber, which means that they can conduct the action potential very, very quickly. So we say they are large in diameter. They begin at the apex and extend into the remainder of the ventricular myocardium. So the pathway then is everything is initiated from the SA node, which travels through the atria. When it gets close to it, it gets picked up by the AV node. From the AV node, it travels into the bundle. From the bundle, it splits into the right and left bundle branches. And at the apex of the heart, they further continue on as Purkinje fibers. And this is the entire conduction pattern of the heart. And how do we measure it? What's it look like? This is a little side thing. It's this thing right here. I'll put it down here. Well, I'll do it black. What's that? Seen that 100 times on movies and TV shows? Right? That is an EKG. That's an electrocardiograph. And all those three,
the little button at the front, the up and down, and the one at the back literally represents the polarized and repolarized state of the myocardium as that signal travels from the sinoatrial node all the way to the Purkinje fibers. This right here, I'm not going to examine you on this, just for interest sake, so you have a sense of it. This is called the P wave, this is called the QRS, and this is called the T wave. The P wave represents depolarization of the atria. The QRS represents depolarization of the ventricles, and the T wave represents repolarization of the ventricles. What's missing? Atria. The only reason is because that's happening at the same time as this, and this is a much bigger charge. It's in behind it, and you can't see it. So what this, when you see an EKG or a 2-lead in the hospital and someone in there, and they're all hooked up, and you can see the little thing blipping along there, it is truly measuring the electrical current that is running through the heart with every single beat. And if we have a heart, where did I tell you the most common heart attack was? Do you remember? Anterior, descending. Remember the one that travels through the anterior sulcus down through into the apex? That's one of the most common areas for heart attack or getting a bit distal to it. So you might hear, for example, in an ECG that someone has a bundle branch block, because what's happened is they've had a heart attack right here, and it's killed the muscle part there, and the conduction pathway also gets damaged, and you get these funky ECGs. That's just for interest sake. I won't spend too much time on it. I could talk about it for hours because, again, it was my life for 10 years. So, bundle of his, yes. Bundle branches. So bundle branches are always bundle branches. Purkinje fibers are always Purkinje fibers. AV node is always AV node. And the atrioventricular bundle more often is known as HIS than the AV bundle. But it can be either. Yeah. But for your purposes, I just want you to understand that the conduction goes from SA to AV to bundle branches to Purkinje fibers. So you can see it here, it's nicely in the slide. Here's your SA node traveling to the AV node, down the bundle, into the bundle branches, where the bundle branches then divide out into the Purkinje fibers, and all the myocardium of the heart is innervated. And again, it is not directed by the brain and the nervous system. It's directed by the autorhythmicity of the myocardium themselves. In fact, if there's damage done to the SA node, other parts of the atria can initiate rhythm as well. They are known as ectopic beats. So you can get different areas of the atria that can initiate. In fact, there's enough damage done, you can actually have muscle cells or myocardium in the heart initiating beats from the ventricles. And when that happens, the heart is actually beating bottom top, bottom top, bottom top. Seen it lots of times. And that has to do with heart disease, post-myocardial infarction, and so forth. So we'll just give you a sense that it happens. As a general rule, the farther away the initiator is from the SA node, the slower the heartbeat. So ventricular rhythms that are initiated are in the high 30s to low 40s. So you'll see heart rates of 40, 42. I still don't believe that. Yeah, what they're saying is, so you probably saw in the movies way back in the day, if someone's heart stopped, the physician will come along and whack, you know, the big pump on the heart, and it makes the heart jiggle and possibly stimulates it to beat. It's called a pericardial thump. And yeah, it's actually called pericardial thump, right? It doesn't work with a dam. The only thing that works really is the paddles, you know. They're the ones that work the best. But in times it will work. So what they're saying is, because you still have, right, if you look at the QR, if you look at the ECG here, you do have periods of time here
and here and here and here, nothing's happening. It's within that time that he got hit that they claim that because it got jiggled really badly in here, it didn't initiate the next step and everything shut down. Yeah. Now, if it's true, the dude should have got out and bought a lottery ticket because that's a lottery you don't want to win, but, man, the chances are so ridiculously low. But so normal cardiac muscle is a stable resting potential as compared to the autorhythmic fibers. So the autorhythmic fibers do not have a stable resting potential. So in other words, this right here with more positive on the outside and the inside, those that initiate the contractions or the actual potential, they have a very unstable resting potential. But the rest of the cells, even though they can initiate, they have a much more stable resting potential, and they require the initial stimulation from the SA node in order to contract. But they still can. Anybody here get extra beats once in a while? Lying in bed and you hear, whoop, whoop, kind of this weird thing. Yeah. Really? Anybody here in really good shape has resting rates down into the 40s? Not even you. It's a sign of fitness. So the lower your resting rate, do you have a watch that does your heart rate? But you don't wear it all the time? Okay. Lower resting rate, the more in shape someone's considered to be because the heart is so strong and muscular, it's meeting the cardiac output without beating as many times. That's the whole purpose. Right? So, but what happens is when that rate gets down into, because my resting rate, the best I ever got to was 42. But that's when I was running tries and all that kind of stuff years and years and years ago. But because I was so low, I would get these extra beats all the time because they would slip in. Because what happens is, whenever the rate slows down in the SA node, these guys are kind of waiting like, hello, when are we going to get stimulated? Where are you? Well, you're not here. Boof, they hit. So you get this boop in your chest. It's benign, but it can get kind of scary. Kind of like you're lying in bed and you feel like your heart like did a right-hand turn or something, right? The fibers are stimulated by the continuation of the action potential along the fibers. And as I said, the gap junctions increase the speed of the movement of the action potential. Now, within that, the action potential stimulates the opening of voltage-gated fast sodium channels. And by opening those, they produce a rapid depolarization, but within a few milliseconds, they're done, and then you get sodium after, right? You get a decrease in sodium. So the action, what has to happen? We need to have this charge difference, right? So we look here at the more positive, more negative. That has to do with the collection of ions inside versus outside. So we could say that there's more of one ion on the outside compared to the other. That excess ion on the outside of the membrane happens to be a positive ion, therefore the outside's more positive, okay? So we're saying that when we have an action potential to flip it, what we're actually doing is stimulating, through that voltage change, pumps that pump sodium. So what is a voltage-gated fast sodium channel? You guys know what it is. Even though you think you don't know what it is. It is an integral protein that acts as a pump, okay? And it's an active membrane transport system. So it requires the charge to pump. So that's all it is. But it just happens to have a specialty for sodium. So therefore, we call it a sodium pump or a sodium fast-gated. So in other words, the gate opens up very, very quickly, but slows down very, very quickly. As compared to skeletal muscle, there is a maintained polarization called the plateau phase, and this in part to the opening of voltage-gated slow calcium channels. What does that mean? Anybody want to take a picture of this? Because I'm about to rub it off. Oh yeah, holy cow. Wow. Who did the memo?
That was your earlier
I'll repeat. As compared to skeletal muscle, there is maintained polarization. So what happens when we look at skeletal muscle? Again, we have our resting state. Okay. And then, of course, an action potential comes along and we flip it. So this represents the depolarization. And I want you to think that it runs across the sarcolemma or the muscle's membrane like the ripples on a pond when you throw a stone in the water. Does everybody understand that? So the action potential travels along the membrane in all directions, affecting the membrane as it goes along, depolarizing it. Does that make sense to everybody? Like a ripple in a pond. That means that it's right here, the depolarization's right here, but it hasn't got here yet. And we're going to say that this depolarization has a net movement in this direction, right? It's heading that way. So that means that this is repolarized, because if this was the start point on the left, if this was the start of the action potential, and the net movement's this way, then this would have started out being depolarized. But as the wave moved on, behind it, it repolarized. The wave is moving in this direction, so this is about to become depolarized, because it's polarized right now, right? It's going to depolarize, and then behind it, this is going to repolarize back to the resting state, okay? And that happens all very quickly. So when you have a muscle contraction in skeletal muscle, right, you get the contraction and the relaxation quite quickly. In cardiac muscle, you get the contraction and it holds for a brief moment. So if you looked at a graph of skeletal muscle, it would do this, right? Really quick depolarization, really quick repolarization. In cardiac muscle, it looks like this. So it sustains the contraction ever so slightly. Why? Because, right, we want to get one last squeeze out. So we hold it to squeeze it all out so that we get the blood out of the chamber. So as compared to skeletal muscle, there's a maintained polarization called the plateau phase. And this is in part due to an opening of another channel called a slow calcium channel. So it too is voltage gated. So remember, when we flipped, we created voltage. So our first one was a real quick gate that opened that initiated the action potential. And then we have a slow gate that maintains the contraction before it drops. Okay? Now, voltage, this increase of calcium results in contraction. It holds the contraction. Voltage-gated potassium channels, now they're involved with potassium, they allow potassium ions to leave the contractile fiber, which of course results in this sustained plateau. So we have three ions involved in cardiac contraction: sodium, calcium, and potassium. Anybody here ever heard of a calcium channel blocker? You're going to come across it as a medication for hypertension. So by blocking calcium, what happens to the contraction? It's going to be less. Therefore, less contraction means less pressure, which might equal lowering blood pressure. Okay? This is why we have these certain some of these drugs, because we're affecting the interaction of the ions at the cellular level of the muscles to affect diseases in some ways, at sometimes. Okay? So we have the three ions that are happening here. When we look at this, first we had the fast gated that began the whole process,
Then we open up the slow gated, which results in increase of calcium, which starts the contraction. Then we have voltage gated and potassium channels, which allow potassium ions to leave the fiber, which further allows ions to be there, which holds the contraction ever so slightly longer. What are we talking about here? In cardiac muscle, this can be sustained, this plateau, for a quarter of a second. In skeletal muscle, it's 1 millisecond. What we're going to learn is, you know how you can hold a contraction? What's happening in the contraction of skeletal muscle is ticks. You get, that's how often the stimulation's coming, but you feel that it's a sustained contraction, right? So you have these rapid stimulations, which is holding it. It's the accumulation of those. And we'll talk about those a little bit when we get to skeletal muscle and physiology in that class. But just understand that our big thing here is sustaining and holding this so that we do get that top-bottom, top-bottom, that last little bit that squeezes out, both on the top and on the bottom. Now, repolarization, which we saw here, is the recovery of the resting membrane potential, same as in skeletal. And additional potassium channels open, and the outflow of potassium restores the resting membrane potential. At the same time, the calcium channels close, and everything starts coming down. Now remember, the interaction of actin and myosin are the same. In other words, in the environment where the actin and myosin are, we need to give them a bath of calcium, which exposes that area of myosin, which the calcium that or the actin attaches to, and away we go with contraction. We have to have the fibers, actin and myosin, bathed in calcium in order to have a contraction. Without calcium, we don't get one. Okay? The potassium and sodium and calcium we were talking about at the membrane is slightly different. It's working with maintaining the action potential at the membrane. But the other calcium I'm talking about is the one that's interacting with the myosin, which allows actin to attach, and therefore we have contraction. The interaction of actin and myosin are the same as skeletal, increased calcium as the actin and myosin interact, and we get contraction. Now, we've gone from polarized to depolarized to repolarized. We have something called the refractory period. Now, within the refractory period, in other words, when the membrane is going from depolarized to repolarized, we can't have another contraction occur there, right? It can't happen. And this is known as a refractory period. So a second contraction cannot occur when the membrane is heading from depolarized to repolarized. Due to this, tetanus cannot occur in cardiac muscle cells, which ensures the time for refill. So anybody here ever had muscle stim done where the physios turned the machine up just a little too much and it's stuck? Like it's in contraction, then they turn it back down again, right? That's called tetanus. So I can create a stimulus where the muscle is in a constant state of contraction by having the actin and myosin constantly bathed in calcium, which doesn't give them a chance to relax. That can't happen in cardiac muscle, thankfully. Otherwise, you'd be going, and you get no cardiac output, and you could, right? Well, everybody has had a tetanus shot, right? That's for a particular bacterium that causes masseter to go into tetanus and you can't open your mouth. So it actually spasms and keeps the mouth closed and you can't open it. It's due to a bacterium. I can't remember the name of it. It was terrible. People had it all the time. It was really common with no antibiotics, that kind of stuff. Yeah. Yeah, it was quite common. Yes. Probably not, unless it was death of cells within the myocardium. So you had cardiac tamponade, which I remember I talked about a couple weeks ago. That's what happened. You probably had fluid collection between the pericardium and the heart, and it probably just gave it a bit of a squeeze, and
You probably did. You have rheumatic fever? I just started talking about that in past class last week. Okay. Now, very little ATP is produced anaerobically, right? We know that just from what we learned in metabolism, right? Glucose metabolism. Anaerobically, we don't produce much ATP, but this muscle contracts a lot, right? So it needs a lot of ATP. Therefore, cardiac myocardium relies almost exclusively on aerobic metabolism in the mitochondria. At in a resting heart, ATP comes mainly from the oxidation of fatty acids and glucose only 35%. During exercise, the heart's use of lactic acid produced by the exercising skeletal muscle rises. So it is very important to understand that this is why when you have a clot in a coronary artery and you occlude blood supply to myocardium, you are effectively cutting off oxygen. And therefore, the heart cannot create ATP, and that cells in that area, which is being supplied, if left without oxygen long enough, they will die. And that's what infarct means. That's why it's called a myocardial infarct. That's the appropriate name for a heart attack. Okay? What's that? No, it's infarction. It's an infarct. Infraction. That's interesting. Were they educated in this country? Were they educated in this country? It's an infarction. Okay, so we've got this pathway. We've got these depolarized cells. And by the way, the answer to that question was the most influence for movement of heart between chambers is pressure. Right? When we're talking about what influences the movement of blood through the heart chambers is actually pressure. Okay? Blood doesn't move through chambers without pressure, even if you have got valves. So, all events associated with one heartbeat is called a cardiac cycle. So what you drew in your diagram, you were following a cardiac cycle. Right atria, right ventricle, left atria, left ventricle, along with the movement of the electrical system from SA node, AV node, bundle branch blocks, bundle branches, and Purkinje fibers. So they all represent a cycle, right, of moving through. And you probably saw that in the video that I played earlier. So all events associated with one heartbeat is called a cardiac cycle. It is the systole and diastole of the atria and the systole and diastole of the ventricles. Does that make sense? Right? Systole, diastole, top. Systole, diastole, bottom. Okay? Now, and you represent that through your systolic and diastolic blood pressure. What's the pressure when the heart beats? What's the pressure when the heart is relaxed? Remember, systole is contraction, diastole is relaxation. Okay, so let's talk about atrial systole. So the polarization of the SA node causes atrial depolarization, which in turn causes atrial systole. In other words, atrial contraction. So the SA node stimulates atrial depolarization, which causes atrial contraction. This systole causes further filling of the ventricles, and the end of atrial systole is the start of ventricular diastole. When the atria are finished contracting, the relaxation of the ventricles is just finished. Right? When the contraction of the atria, right? So we're saying, right, depolarization of the SA node causes atrial depolarization. The systole causes further filling of the ventricles. The end of atrial systole is the start of ventricular diastole. Why? We can't have ventricular systole because what's going to happen? Right. You've got to have the atria contract first and the ventricle relax, and then the ventricle contract. Because you can't fill the ventricles via the atria if the ventricle is not relaxed. Great. Okay.
The final volume of blood in the ventricles is called the end diastolic volume. So as the ventricles are relaxed and the atria contract, we get the most fill of blood in the ventricles. That blood that's in the ventricles at the end of atrial contraction is called end diastolic volume, because when the ventricles are finally filled and ready to go, diastole is now over. Because what's going to happen next? The atria have contracted, they've had their fill, the atria are going to start to relax, so the ventricles are going to start to contract, right? Okay, so we can see it here. Here's your diastole and systole. Here is your left atrium, left ventricle. You've got your AV valves open and closed here. So we can see within the cardiac cycle, we get atrial contraction, right? And then we go into ventricular contraction and then atrial filling at the same time. So the ventricular systole, so during ventricular systole, the atria are in diastole. So the atria started to contract first, and of course the ventricles were in diastole relaxation. Now the ventricles are going to start to contract, and as the ventricles are contracting, the atria are relaxing, right? Okay. Ventricular contraction causes a rise in pressure, which shuts the AV valves. Boyle's law. The smaller the container, inversely, the greater the pressure. Correct. So because the atria are relaxed and the ventricles are contracting, the container is getting smaller and pressure is going up. And the pressure, will it be greater in the ventricles than it is in the atria? Yes. So where does blood want to go? Into the right. And why can't it? Because the AV valves, the way they're built, they won't allow blood to go back into the atria. They snap shut, right? Okay. Continued contraction of the ventricles further increases pressure drastically. When the left ventricular pressure passes 80 millimeters of mercury and the right passes 20 millimeters of mercury, the semilunar valves open. So when the pressure in the left ventricle gets above 80, the aortic semilunar valve will open. And when the right ventricle, when the pressure gets to 20, then the pulmonary semilunar valve opens. Okay? But if it's equal, are we going to have movement of blood? So if the pressure in the left ventricle, we're only to get to 80, would we get movement of blood out of the heart? Not yet, no. So what is the existing pressure in blood when you take blood pressure? What is the diastolic number? 80. So if the left ventricle only got to 80, would you get net movement of blood into systemic circulation? No, because it's not enough, right? It has to be more than 80 in order to move blood. But at 80, the valves will open. So continued contraction of the ventricles increases pressure drastically. When the left ventricle pressure passes 80 millimeters of mercury and the right passes 20 millimeters of mercury, the semilunar valves open. This is called ventricular ejection, and it continues until the left reaches 120 and the right reaches 25 to 30. So what you are measuring when you take blood pressure at 120 over 80, you are measuring the pressure that was created by the left ventricle. So I want you all to try something here. I want you to put your pens down, find a partner. Just find a partner. You need to have access to their neck and to their wrist. Neck and wrist. Real quick, this isn't complicated. One therapist, one client. Okay, therapist, please palpate the carotid pulse and then at the same time palpate the radial pulse. You all know where the radial pulse is now. You can find the carotid. Find it. Got it? Now find it. Okay. What's it doing? No, should we go? Did it? Yeah, got that? Okay. So what's happening is
the heart's creating the 120 millimeters of mercury pressure enough to move blood, and it that ripple of that pressure takes a moment or two to get all the way down to the wrist. So you feel it go, da-dum, da-dum, da-dum. Okay? Right? So what you're feeling in the wrist is what was ejected out of the ventricle when it contracts. You're actually feeling the pressure that was created at the left ventricle when it contracted. And that is called ventricular ejection. Now, ventricular repolarization has to happen, right? Because it contracts, it contracted, it ejected blood, now it needs to relax. So ventricular repolarization represents diastole of the ventricles. This, so ventricular repolarization, returning back to the resting state, causes ventricular diastole, which results in a drop of pressure within the ventricles. So the ventricle created pressures of 120 and blood opened up the semilunar valves and blood left the ventricles, the right into pulmonary circulation and the left into systemic, right? Okay. Now the left ventricle and the right ventricle are relaxed and pressure is going to drop. And it's going to drop to below 80. If the pressure in the ventricles, let's say on the left side for now, if the pressure in the left ventricle gets below 80, what does blood want to do? It wants to leave the aorta and go into the ventricle, right? Well, what's going to stop it? The aortic semilunar valves. Okay? It's all about pressure. The container gets larger, Boyle's law, the larger the container, inversely, the less the pressure. So in the ventricle, it will get below 120, so blood's going to want to go flying back into the ventricle, but the semilunar valves are going to slam shut, and the blood's not going to get back in there. So ventricular repolarization causes ventricular diastole, which results in a drop of pressure within the ventricles. As a result, blood starts to flow back into the ventricles, which catches in the semilunar cusps and closes them. As the ventricles continue to relax, pressure drops drastically and the AV valves open because there's more pressure in the atria than there is in the ventricle. So as the semilunar valves are snapping shut, the atrioventricular valves are opening. And blood is going to go from the atria into the ventricles. Okay? So, as the ventricles continue to relax, pressure drops drastically, and the AV valves open, allowing a passive filling of the ventricles. Because remember, under gravity, we pull the floor of the atria out, and a good amount of blood is going to just drop into the ventricles passively before the atria contracts, which then finishes it off. So, once the ventricles pressure goes down, the AV valves open, then a brand new cycle starts all over again. When a physician listens to heart sounds, they're actually listening to the closing of the valves. So they're a little bit behind. Lub dub, lub dub. Lub is AV valves closing. Dub is, sorry. Yeah, lub is AV valves closing and dub is semilunar valves closing. Lub dub, lub dub, lub dub. Okay? All right, how was that? Need a break? See you at 25-2. Okay, let's continue. We have finished the heart. And now we're going to do the blood vessels. So we're working our way away. So, there is your cardiovascular system. So the one on the right is the head and the left is the whole body. Did anybody go to Body Worlds back in the day when they came to the Science Center with the plastinated bodies? I took my wife at the time and I was walking around. I turned around, there was like 30 people following me because I'm doing like a lecture on anatomy, right? And all these people like, do you work here? And I'm like, nope. So this is they put wax or whatever in it, and all the flesh has been removed but the vessels. So that's kind of our normal system. So the cardiovascular system is a closed system which allows for transportation of the blood through the body and, of course, returns it back to the pump, which, of course, is the heart. So this ability is driven by the pump, which is the heart, and the pathways, which is the vessels. The vessels that transport blood away from the heart, in most cases the blood is oxygenated, and we already know that there's one for that, are called arteries, and the vessels that transport blood to the heart, in most cases deoxygenated, in the case there's only one difference in that, are called veins. So they're always traditionally drawn in textbooks and anatomical textbooks. Veins are always in blue, and arteries are always in red. So not unlike the heart had three layers, right? It had an outer layer, a middle layer, and an inner layer. Blood vessels are exactly the same. There are three layers or tunics with a space in the middle called the lumen. So within that tube, that hollow part of the tube is known as the lumen. The outermost layer is called the tunica intima, and this contains endothelium. Oh, sorry, the innermost. I think I said that wrong. The innermost is the tunica intima, and it contains the same endothelium that lined the chambers of the heart. So that smooth, sort of Teflon-like tissue that allows blood to kind of slide through and not bounce around too much, which, of course, then would result in clotting, right? We don't want that. So the intima is the endothelium, which is continuous with the endothelial layer of the heart chambers. The middle layer is called the tunica media, and like the heart, it is the muscular layer of the vessels. So the intima is the innermost layer, right? It lines the inside. The middle layer is the media, which is contains smooth muscle and sheets of elastin in a circular fashion. And it is, we look at the smooth muscle, it's innervated by the sympathetic division of the autonomic nervous system. In other words, the nervous system controls whether or not these muscles contract or relax, which results in changing the diameter of the vessel. Vasodilation getting larger, vasoconstriction getting smaller. The smooth muscle allows for a larger lumen vasodilation or a smaller lumen vasoconstriction. So we can see here, there are some differences here between the two, artery and vein, but ultimately they still have the three layers, the endothelial layer, the muscular layer, and then the outer layer, which is known as the tunica externa. Now, the middle layer is critical in regulating hemodynamics. Remember that law I talked about a resistance on the inside of a vessel that bleeds away the pressure of blood, and that by the time blood gets back to the heart, it's almost at zero, right? Okay, so you can imagine then, if I take a vessel and I have blood running through it, if I constrict that vessel, what's going to happen to the resistance of blood traveling through that vessel if it, in fact, gets smaller in diameter? It's going to, right, our pressure is going to go up. If the vessel is made to be larger in diameter, resistance goes down, and you see how when we talk about hemodynamics, we're talking about, how it influences blood pressure. So this ability to vasodilate or vasoconstrict really does have an influence overall on blood pressure when looking at it. Now, have you guys done pre and post blood pressures in the lab? So ultimately, the blood pressure that you took prior to treatment should be higher than the blood pressure you took post-treatment, correct? Why? Because you had hyperemia. So that hyperemia, that redness of the skin after treatment, is a result of vasodilation of capillaries at the surface level of the blood. So what in fact you've done, you actually lowered resistance by having hyperemia and vasodilation due to your techniques on the skin. And you've lowered resistance, therefore, it shows hemodynamically throughout the entire system. This is where, this is a bit of a bitch by me, I don't understand why we get so bent out of shape with hypertension and massage. Because in fact, if we actually do this, then we should actually be able to affect and lower blood pressure. Their concern is that we're, by moving fluids, we may be actually increasing volume to the heart that's dealing with a hypertensive state, and it might be detrimental to the heart.
Sorry,
Yeah, or also you've got the carotid artery there, so you don't want to potentially really occlude bilaterally in that area, because you could ultimately, if you went down bilaterally, you could occlude blood into the brain by somewhat narrowing the carotids if you're working deeply bilaterally, and then you lower input into the brain, and the patient might go for a little sleep. The UFC shows that all the time. Called a chokehold. The tunica media is more defined in arteries as compared to veins. Why? Why would we have a thicker, stronger muscle layer in arteries as compared to veins? Not volume. Greater pressure, right? So because the arterial side has more pressure, we need a stronger muscular wall in order to deal with it. And because, as we said, pressure diminishes when blood leaves the arterial side and goes into the venous side, then we don't need big, thick muscular walls on the venous side, because it's not dealing with the same kind of internal pressures that are traveling through it. Remember that when you're taking blood pressure, you are in fact actually measuring arterial pressures, not venous pressures, right? Hence the reason why you palpate the what before you do blood pressure? The brachial artery. Okay? The external layer is called the tunica externa, or also the tunica adventitia. And then, of course, it is basically collagen fibers, and it's the outer layer. Within the outer layer, we find nerve fibers, lymphatic vessels, and in big, large veins, a network of elastin fibers. When we look at the largest of the vessels at this external layer, we actually find tiny blood vessels. And the tiny blood vessels that are found in this outer layer are the very large vessels, is known as the vasovasorum. So it's actually supplying it. And not unlike the heart, the blood that flows through the vessel does not supply the myocardium. That vessel is lined with endothelium to prevent clotting. So therefore, we have to have, not unlike the heart, a superficial network to feed the muscular wall. Yes. The lumen is the hole in the middle. Blood travels through the lumen. And so as I said when I was talking about myocardial infarction, if I have a blood clot that blocks the artery, it is in fact blocking the lumen, which then blood can't travel through. So the arterial system, it is divided into three divisions. The first is known, and I don't know why I have this in plural, because there really only is one elastic artery in the entire body, so it should be kind of singular. They're found near the heart and have very thick walls. Well, I guess you could say the initial branches off the artery could be considered elastic, maybe the reason why. It represents the aorta and its branches. They're the largest in diameter. Now, the largest, of course, is the aorta itself. Approximately 2.5 to 1 centimeter, depending on it. So the aorta obviously being slightly larger, and the direct branches off it, of course, a little bit smaller. It is the most elastic, so therefore it must have a lot of elastic fibers in it, right? Okay. They're considered to be a low resistance pathway. Because of the largeness of the diameter, they allow blood to flow through directly out of the heart very easily with very little resistance. So blood travels through. They are also known as conducting arteries. So the branches directly off of the aorta conduct blood to areas. So in the arch, which is the more proximal part of the aorta, it's conducting blood to the head and upper limbs. Through the torso, it's conducting blood to the organs within the torso and some of the musculature. We get down to the lower part of the abdominal, same idea, it's conducting into the abdominal organs. And then when we get into the iliacs, which is where the aorta splits right around the belly button, that's conducting blood, of course, to the lower limbs. They contain the highest percentage of elastin, and this is present in all three layers, with media having the most. So the tunica intima, tunica media, and tunica externa all contain elastic fibers. So it's a very elastic vessel. These vessels are pressure reservoirs, and this produces the continuous flow of blood. So we need to understand, and you kind of felt it. So when you palpated the carotid artery and you palpated the radial artery, you probably noted that you had the beat proximal first and then the beat distal after. Very short period of time, but it actually went bang, 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 right? Well, if we think about the cycle of the heart and the ventricle will stay on the left side. It has to achieve a pressure of greater than 80 to 120 in order to move blood along, right? So the pressure goes up, blood squirts out, pressure goes down, AV valve closes, and there's no net movement of blood out of the ventricles at that point, correct? Right, does that make sense? Pressure goes up, blood leaves the heart, pressure goes down, AV valve closes, no movement of blood out of the ventricle. What did I say happens when blood stops? Clots. Blood can never stop. So how, if we're getting ejection, nothing, ejection, nothing, how then does blood continuously move throughout the body? Because we can't have it stop or it clots. When the heart contracts and blood goes out into the aorta, because of these elastic walls, the aorta expands and it's getting loaded, if you want to use that term. And then when the ventricles go into diastole, or left one we're talking about, then that expansion of the aorta and its elastic fibers comes back to normal, thus continuing to push move blood forward. And as soon as that recoil is done, poof, another rejection's happened. So blood never, ever stops. So in other words, the aorta is reserving the pressure that was created by the left ventricle and using it to continue moving blood along until the next beat. Does that make sense? Okay. So blood is never stopping. So that it's because these reserve the pressure. So we say they're said to be pressure reservoirs, which produces a continuous flow of blood. Of course, if this property is affected, it increases pressures on the more distal arteries. So as we get older and possibly disease states, we could in fact have sclerosis or hardening of the aorta, and then it loses its ability to stretch and reserve that pressure. So then the heart has to push harder, and then you can see where you get a hypertensive response to try to keep things kind of moving along, right? So we can see it here. Here's our tunica externa, our tunica media here. We get basement membranes, just like, you know, we talked about epithelial tissue. We got basement membranes here. As far as that goes, we can see the white kind of Swiss cheesy kind of stuff represents elastic fibers. So we can see we've got layers of it throughout. And then, of course, here's the lumen here with the tunica intima in between, which is endothelial tissue. So we've gone from elastic arteries, which is the aorta and its branches. And remember, on the arterial side, blood vessels start large and become smaller as they travel farther away. So now we're going to step down a size. So the next side are the muscular arteries. So we're continuing distally from the elastic arteries. They're responsible for delivering blood to specific organs and thus are named accordingly. So we have hepatic arteries, renal arteries, gastric arteries, right? Subclavian artery, axillary artery, brachial artery, and so forth. Okay? They're named where they are. They range from anywhere from 1 centimeter to 0.3 millimeters in diameter. By the way, I didn't mention this. Your aorta is basically slightly larger than your garden hose. If you want an idea of how much pressure is in there, if I were to take a large knife and cut you through, that opened the aorta, and the wound remained open, and I took the knife out, the blood would squirt approximately 6 feet out of your chest. That's the kind of pressure that's in there. So I always laugh at horror films when someone gets stabbed and nothing happens. One time in the hospital, there was a lover's quarrel. A lover's triangle happened one night at a party in Orillia. And the young lady decided to go with one gentleman, and the other gentleman was very unhappy that the young lady went with the other guy. And he went back after the party and went into the bedroom and proceeded to stab the gentleman to death. Unfortunately, he didn't realize everybody was under the covers, and he put the knife through and he actually cut the young lady's artery in half, or her left ventricle in half, when he plunged the knife in. When the paramedics got there, they said it was like someone took a can of paint and painted the entire room in red, because that's how much pressure is in there. So, you know, whenever you see movies where someone gets stabbed and or they get cut in the throat and it's just kind of trickled out. Yeah, it's not quite the way it happens. Exactly. So that's the kind of pressure that's in there. Yeah. Okay. That's the kind of pressure. All right. So where they go is what they're called. Now, these vessels contain the thickest media, and the media has a higher percentage of smooth muscles compared to elastin. So the elastic fibers had a very large percentage of elastin with a fairly thick muscular wall. But these actually have not as much elastin and lots of muscles. In other words, they're much more involved in vasoconstriction and dilation, so more constriction than not. So they are, if I want blood to go, say I've got two arteries heading in both directions, and there was a greater demand over here than here, then this one will constrict a little bit, and of course blood will follow the path of least resistance, so off it will go to where it's needed. And when you're done, it starts to constrict, another one opens, is how we conduct through. Do you know that you have so many miles of blood vessels in your body that if they all opened as wide as they could all at once, you would die because you haven't got enough blood to go around all of them? So you are opening and closing vessels based upon demand all the time in your body. Yeah, you haven't got enough blood to go around if they all opened up. So we can see here, we've got our elastic artery here, and we've got our muscular artery here. Arterioles, then, are the next smaller down. They are the smallest of the arteries. They go from 0.3 millimeters to about 10 nanometers, so which is pretty darn tiny. Okay, the larger arterioles do contain all three layers, and the media is smooth muscle with very little elastic fibers at all. The arterioles are the last vessel before the capillary. So they're the smallest. That's why they're such a variation in size. They'll get smaller and smaller and smaller until they get out to the capillary. So once we say the capillary bed, these vessels are nothing more than an endothelial lining and a single layer of smooth muscle. There's not much to them at all. They're so tiny. So we can see here that here's the endothelial layer here, kind of in the red. And we can see just the tiniest bands of smooth muscle, which, of course, will influence diameter of these vessels up or down, depending, you know, getting vasodilated or vasoconstricted. So we can see here's the muscular artery here in this point in the picture on the bottom left, or bottom right, sorry. And we can see the arterioles that are branching off and getting smaller and smaller. And it is arterioles that also help make up the capillary bed itself, very, very tiny vessels. Okay, I guess I'll leave it at that. Is there supposed to be a quiz next week? Yeah, well, at this point, okay, so I'll have one next week. We have to finish the heart and a bit of the vessels. Some people want them now. Yeah, you're right. They want to get those last couple in to see how it goes as far as that goes. It was a yay. But if you've got four and you got, like, say, four tens, for example, it's up to you. Right. So if you have four good ones, you might say, yeah, I'll come and try it, but I don't care. Yeah. See ya.